This podcast is primarily recorded on the traditional territories of the Huron-Wendat and Haudenosaunee peoples, in Cataraqui, or Kingston by its colonial name. We center the rightful stewards of this land in order to unsettle our fight for collective liberation. Hello and welcome to another episode of Queer Muslim Resistance, a podcast from Oparig Kingston. I'm one of your hosts, Maha, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Amira, a queer and trans Muslim who is based in St. Paul, Minnesota, also known as Imnizaska to the Dakota. We have a conversation about what it means to be in right relationship with the land. Stay tuned. Hi, Amira.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good, alhamdulillah.
Awesome.
It's really cold and snowy here in Minnesota. It's like the 20th of October. It snowed 5 inches here, and I've never had it snow that much so early in my life.
Yeah.
So, yeah, getting used to it, but yeah.
It's still pretty fall-ish where I am, so trees still have most of their leaves, or some of their leaves at least.
Don't rub it in.
So to get us started, do you mind telling us a little bit about yourself? So your pronouns, your background, where you're based, or whatever else you'd like to share?
Yeah, so salam everyone. My name is Amira Khan. I use she, her, hers pronouns. I am a transgender, queer, Muslim, DevOps engineer, polyglot, based out of Minnesota, St. Paul, Minnesota at this current moment. Before that, I was in Madison, Wisconsin, and before that, I was in St. Louis, Missouri, so very Midwest gal my whole life. Yeah.
Awesome. So the first question that I have for you to get readers, or not readers, listeners, to get them to know a little bit more about you and your relationship to Islam, what did your introduction to Islam look like?
Yeah, so I was what a lot of people will call like born Muslims, right? When you can go into the details and be like, technically everyone is born on the fitrah and this and that, but I was raised in a Muslim household. That was Bengali out of St. Louis, Missouri, specifically Baldwin, Missouri and West County, which people who are familiar with the geography will know that that's kind of a more affluent sort of neighborhood. It's I was not part of an affluent family there. I was very lower class, and I remember growing up like on food stamps and knowing how to identify like what items in the grocery store are approved for like WIC and stuff like that and for food stamps. But I was surrounded by a very wealthy, affluent Muslim community that sort of funded the masjid that was the community center. And I went to a public school that was funded by relatively wealthy taxpayer dollars. So yes, wealthy and white, but my little bubble that I grew up in within the masjid community was more wealthy, like slightly more conservative, what many people would call mainstream Muslims in the sort of Desi and Arab sort of background, right? So the Indian subcontinent and Arab background. So I grew up very much immersed in that community, and my mother, knowing how much that she wanted Islam to be part of my life, she essentially would take me to the masjid at every chance she got. So she herself had a spiritual awakening sort of when she came to the United States to be like, wow, I really need to take my religion seriously. And so she started going to the masjid a lot, like often, and I was just like a kid, and so she dragged me along, and I listened to a lot of Islamic lectures growing up. I sort of absorbed a lot of it like via diffusion, and then I was formally put in a Quran Hifz school from around fifth grade until 2009, and I during that time 2009 was maybe like eighth grade for me, and during that time I had finished memorizing the entire Quran cover to cover, giving me the title of Hafila, or right? So someone who has memorized the Quran. And after that, I remained very active in the Muslim community, even though I was not actively like memorizing the Quran or in Quran class or anything, by leading like Taraweeh prayers at masjids in the St. Louis area that needed like imams for the Ramadan night prayers, and giving khutbas at like different masajid, organizing with the MSA on campus when I began college. Mm-hmm. So my entire life really revolved around Islam for so much of my life. Mm-hmm. And so much of my self-worth came from that identity, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could say I'm acquainted.
Mm-hmm. And was this Sunni Islam, just to confirm?
This was relatively mainstream Sunni Islam, yes. Predominantly, my community was Hanafi. That said, later on in my life, my like maybe say freshman to sophomore, so this would be around 2014 to 2016 and until present, really. Mm-hmm. My mother, who really ran our household, it's a household full of strong women, I assure you now. Mm-hmm. She really became like attracted to the Salafism aspect, which was not a good thing for me, but that meant that I drew closer and closer to Salafism for like maybe the 2014 mm-hmm. onward part of my life, 2014 to 2016, let's say. So yeah. And so for folks unacquainted, Salafism is sort of like an ultra-orthodox brand of Islam within sort of the what is considered mainstream, and it is on paper anyway, it is officially the orthodoxy, like the tariqa, the branch of Islam, let's say, that the Saudi government follows and has been exporting culturally since the 70s, let's say. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Via spiritual colonialism, essentially, is what I call it. But let's mm-hmm. well, that's a different topic.
Yeah, for sure, we could have a whole episode just on that. You have some really interesting ways of thinking about the relationships that folks have to land and migration and the frameworks mm-hmm. of indigeneity itself. So what's your relationship to the land that you're on?
Yeah, so of course, here in St. Paul, Minnesota, we are on stolen, colonized Anishinaabe, Ojibwe, and Lakota land. Mm-hmm. And all of the United States is stolen land, we know this. And I think as someone who is non-Indigenous on Indigenous land, on stolen land, right? Whether or not I am like white, I'm still of settler descent, right? Or immigrant descent in this case, right? So like the definitions there can be a little bit blurry, but as someone who is not Indigenous on this land, I think my essential duty is to be someone who is in a right relationship with the land on a personal and community level, mm-hmm. but then B, in solidarity with all of those communities who are rightfully caretakers of the land, right? And this merges into the idea of like Khalifa that we have in Islam, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Right, so it's like, I'll quote from the Quran after I put my phone on vibrate, real quick. So when God created Adam, when Allah created Adam, the Quran says, وَإِذْ قَالَ رَبُّكَ لِلْمَلَائِكَةِ إِنِّي جَاعِلٌ فِي الْأَرْضِ خَلِيفَةً قالوا وتجعل فيها من يفسد فيها ويسفك الدماء ونحن نسبح بحمدك ونقدس لك قال إني أعلم ما لا تعلمون. صدق الله العظيم. So this is basically where God in the Quran says, I'm going to put on earth a khalifa, right? And I'll get into the meanings of that word later. And then the angels respond, قَالُوا أَتَجْعَلُ فِيهَا مَا يُفْسِدُ فِيهَا. Are you going to put on this earth people or beings that will create fasad or mischief in the earth and like ruin it and hurt it, right? وَيَسْفِكُ الدِّمَاءَ, they will spill blood. They will spill blood, right? وَنَحْنُ نَصَبِّحُ بِحَمْدِكَ وَنَقَدِّسُ لَكَ. And we are angels. We don't do any of that stuff, right? We're pure. God responds with, قَالَ إِنِّي أَعْلَمُ مَا لَا تَعْلَمُونَ. Indeed, I know what you do not know.
Mm-hmm.
So God's purpose for putting us on here is still not clear from that verse.
Mm-hmm.
But we know God is all-knowing. And as is shown by this conversation, God knew that human beings were going to be like not cool, right? Not cool to each other and not cool to Mother Earth, right? And so I think the way that I look at it, the way that I look at my religion and God's ask and relationship to indigeneity and indigenous peoples who we are in community with is solidarity, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea that my purpose is to be in community and helpful to those communities who are rightful stewards of the land, right? So this idea of Khalifa is often translated as successor, but that lends its idea, or inheritor, and that lends its idea that whenever the previous generation dies, we get it, right? And this concept is not just, nor is it Islamic, right? In Islam, we also have the concept of redistribution of wealth if it is not being used, period. So like people who are like hoarding so much wealth, right, and are not reinvesting it into society, that wealth can be seized in order to stimulate the economy because it is not doing much, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, I mean, that's a concept we have in our religion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I translate that financial sort of principle to the idea of being in community with indigenous folks and who in my opinion are the rightful owners. Ugh, I don't like the word owners, but the rightful people to be in relationship with the land, and not settler colonialists who have imposed capitalism and all of its sort of byproducts onto it, right? And the byproducts we see, the deforestation of the Amazon, right? The widening of all of these holes in the ozone layer, the extinction of like different species and like biodiversity, all of these things, right, are at their core unethical and at their core hurting the earth and hurting the things that we as human beings rely on to survive. So it's completely not sustainable, capitalism as a long-term, you know, system of exploitation. And so basically in solidarity and fighting against that exploitation, indigenous folks have always been there. They've been standing at the pipelines, right, that Justin Trudeau is allowing oil companies to build on stolen land. Indigenous folks have been fighting here in the Twin Cities for just general sovereignty and recognition, like for fighting for their human like dignity and rights to live, right? Which is not land, but it is connected to the land, right? So that's how I see it. That I see that my religion, my existence in this community, in this world, as an ethical being, someone who wants to leave the world a better place than when I came here, comes in sort of humbling myself and being in community with those folks, right? And that means not talking over them, not imposing on them, not being like, I know what's best for you all. And that includes sort of joining in that fight for sovereignty of land and of humans.
Yeah. You talk about being in right relationship with the land, and you've touched on that, talking about the word Khalifa and what that means as well. How do you personally and collectively work to be in right relationship with the land?
Yeah, So that is something that it looks different for everyone depending on your situation, right? But a lot of things that you can do is, you know, work in like sort of community gardens, right? Just for very physical, you and the land, right? But then there's also the community aspect to it, right? Yeah. And this again is like less about land, but all of these concepts are connected. But right after this interview, in fact, I'm running off to be a car marshal for a march for Black Lives. Mm-hmm. And so I've been connected with sort of the Twin City Marshals group, and I've been joining them, and also Twin Cities Coalition for Justice for Jamar, which has been in contact, like personal contact, with the victims of police brutality in the Twin Cities area.
Mm-hmm.
So while those aren't necessarily land specific, right, those are movements for justice, and the idea of land is intricately like connected with all of those, right? The idea of like who is indigenous and indigenous people leading these protests, and Native Lives Matter, and like Black lives, and how they have been, you know, sort of descendants of slaves have been kidnapped and brought across here for economic gain and profit. Mm-hmm. And also in that economic gain, they stewarded the land as well. That was their literal role, right?
Mm-hmm.
Giving them sort of an element of indigeneity as well.
Mm-hmm.
So so all of these things are connected. And even if I'm not directly working with land, I'm working with people who are sort of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I find it so interesting that your approach is to thinking about land and all that comes with that is to broaden the definition of indigenous to include more folks. Because the way that I've explored this previously in like my own academic work is through trying to further complicate the indigenous settler binary, right? Because we're not all easily categorizable, I guess, into either indigenous or settler, depending on how we came to be on these lands. So I've read Jody Bird's Transit of Empire, or at least just the introduction. And they take the term arrivants from poet Camus Brathwaite as signifying, quote, those people forced into the Americas through the violence of European and Anglo-American colonialism and imperialism around the globe, unquote. So Vimalasri et al., so these are things I will all be linking in the episode description for folks who are interested in reading more. They contextualize this category as, quote, rooted in a Black Caribbean poetics of being in place, gesturing to the multiple fundamentally unsettled and unsettling relations to a place that manifests specifically in Black geographies, unquote. I borrow from Black geographical thought to help me explore this idea of being in place, as opposed to valorizing a certain placelessness, as can be common for folks in the diaspora. And so I propose that we build on the concept of being in colonial place, which is doing the work that you're doing, right? And that we are doing when we are in solidarity with Indigenous folks, by centering the coloniality of nation state formations in order to mobilize and create anti-colonial belongings beyond the notions of Canadianness or Americanness. So which thinkers, schools of thought, or experiences have inspired you in your framings of indigeneity and colonialism?
Yeah, first of all, I'm gonna give some props to that quote right there. Really, really good. And I think it links that idea of like anti-settler or anti-colonialist action, mm-hmm. rather,
mm-hmm.
is pro-land action.
Yeah.
Essentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in that idea of that, you know, fighting the state which is exploiting the land and hurting the earth, that is a fight for the land.
Mm-hmm.
As for specific thinkers, I am not going to quote too many because these are things that I have sort of not read too much theory personally. These are concepts that I have been in community with Black folks and Indigenous folks and have learned from them, essentially, right? And so I learned from the people who've done the research. I personally have not done the research, and that, if you want to put it that way. So one of the people who has who has made me think about sort of blackness as having an element of indigeneity is Taylor Amari Little.
Okay.
She is a black queer Muslim based out of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And she uses she and he pronouns and does a lot of like root work, right? So hoodoo divination and ancestral healing and all of these sorts of work. Mm-hmm. So she has a podcast, Tay in the Water. Go listen to it.
Yeah.
And in it, she explores one of the episodes. She does explore this like line between like, well, who's indigenous? Like, at what point does someone become indigenous, right? Like, my ex was five generations Wisconsinite.
Mm.
So, like, we joked and called her a Wisconsin native, but she's very white. She's of Irish descent, right? Doesn't have sort of tribal blood, if you want to say that. So, mm-hmm. so like, that's just, you know, at what point does someone become indigenous? And the definition that we have of that is also influenced by settler colonial like ideas. So another podcast that I've listened to is All My Relations by two indigenous women who host this. They're phenomenal. I love them so much. And they have an episode where they talk about how they talk about the blood quantum idea, right? Yeah. Which is that if you have X percentage of native or tribal blood in you, then you are considered to be indigenous, right? Or part of the tribe, right? Mm-hmm. And how they're like, well, this is actually in contrast to the idea of blackness, right? And who gets to be black, right? So who gets to be black is the one drop rule. If you have a little bit of black in you, then you're considered black. Mm-hmm. Right, as far as these definitions go. But then the blood quantum rules, well, you have to be sort of 50% or higher, or they have to be registered with the tribe and all of these things to actually be considered native. Well, if you take both of these, these are both in the interest of the settler colonial state, mm-hmm. because indigenous people have a right to the land because they were here first. So if you can disenfranchise them from having the right to the land by limiting who gets to be native in the first place, this is an effective method for settler colonialism, right?
Yeah.
And if you and then on the flip side, right, if you get to say, well, you just like, okay, you're maybe half black, maybe you're 25% black, but you're still black, you still get to be my slave, right? Mm-hmm. In that sense, right? Then that's also in the interest of furthering the settler colonial state, because that means more people mm-hmm. to work and generate you a profit as a plantation owner or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. So both of these definitions are definitions that settlers came up with mm-hmm. in interest of the settler colonial state. So we have to break apart these definitions first to determine like, okay, what is indigeneity? And so when I come to that question, and I think about it with sort of the input from other people, then it's like, yes, it is, are you in community, in right relationship with the land? And that does not mean you as an individual, because of course, mm-hmm. also the idea of focusing on like you as a human, you are your own thing. That's also like an individualist as opposed to a collectivist idea, which is, you can talk about how that's also part of the settler colonial state, right?
Yeah.
Not that it's good or bad, but it's just a different way of organizing societies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I look at it as like, are you A, in right relationship with the land, but also B, are you in right relationship with a community that is in right relationship with the land? So it's not just an individualistic definition, it's a collectivist definition.
So in our earlier correspondence, you mentioned the ancient African proverb, if you go alone, you will go fast, but if you go together, you will go far. So how do you work to heal with you and your community?
Yeah, so when it comes to collective healing, I think so much of that is in grief and justice and all of the full sort of range of of like human emotions and needs that we have and need to fulfill, right? Mm-hmm. And specifically American society, right? There's this idea that like, oh, you only get like 10 vacation days in a year, right? And the rest of it, you're just like work, right? And obviously we know that this is unhealthy, especially in pandemic times, right? Because so much of this employment is tied to people's health insurance, and therefore with the health insurance system that doesn't provide health insurance to many people who need it, right? Mm-hmm. Or is too expensive for them to afford it. We fall into this huge mess that we see in 2020, right? Mm-hmm. When I think of collective healing, and I imagine like a banner saying no justice, no peace, mm-hmm. because I don't think people can heal properly without having justice. Justice is a basic human need for a community. Mm-hmm. Malcolm X said, "You can stick a knife 9 inches in me, and if you pull it out three inches, that is not progress. Mm-hmm. If you pull the knife out all the way and then allow the wound to start healing, now that is progress."
Yeah.
Right? And so for so many communities, the knife is still in the body, right? Mm-hmm. So for Black communities, they're still being disproportionately targeted by police themselves. They are still militarized and armed by all of these corporations that benefit off of arms dealings. Mm-hmm. So I think collective healing, first of all, is allowing our communities the basic range of what it means to be human, mm-hmm. and begging at the foot of an empire that refuses to deliver justice on the death of people consistently, that is not being human. That is relegating the Black community and the community of victims of police brutality to an inhuman level. So the first like step in sort of in collective healing is being able to regain your humanity. And so much of regaining your humanity is tied up in the ideas of needing justice and seeking justice. Mm-hmm. Some of it is sort of tied up in the idea of collective healing or like public grief, mm-hmm. right? And so the idea of that, so like creating an autonomous zone for people to like celebrate and have joyous occasions and also mourn and grieve together, mm-hmm. and just experience a full range of what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. In community, right? That is the idea of making this collectively. Yeah. And of course we live in an American sort of capitalistic treadmill that doesn't allow us to take, you know, days off. It's out of like 10 days a year for mm-hmm. And of course there's bereavement and all of these things, but they're not built the way that our communities need for proper grieving, right? Mm-hmm. If your son dies and you're not going to take off 2 weeks and then go back to work, right? That is going to last with you.
Yeah.
So part of regaining our humanities and part of collective healing is dismantling the systems that prevent us from being human in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I love that emphasis on dismantling the systems and not trying to reform those systems, because we all know that reform doesn't really do much. So
reform can help, but I'm sort of agnostic on the stance of like reform versus versus like dismantle, mm-hmm. but I lean towards the abolitionist sort of dismantling for specific things, and specifically with the police, right? Mm-hmm. Specifically with the idea of the police force, I don't think that reform is going to be a proper solution or a lasting solution in terms mm-hmm. of demilitarizing mm-hmm. and like removing bias, right, against racial minorities.
Right. So the final question is, what would you like any listening queer Muslims to take away from your stories?
Yeah. Mm. So we did not spend most of this podcast talking about the queer Muslim experience, but if there are queer Muslims out there listening to this, I want y'all to know that you are seen, you are loved, and by God, even though, no matter whatever your community tells you, God made you queer. God made you LGBTQ. And that was her plan. That was her intention. And God doesn't make mistakes. Mm-hmm. So whoever tells you that you're a mistake is the one who doesn't know the divine and her beauty. There's also, for me personally, I take this story to heart. There was, there is a trans man in St. Louis, Missouri. His name is Sayer Johnson. Mm-hmm. He has founded the group called MTUG, the Metro Trans Umbrella Group.
Okay.
And this group has been providing a lot of direct aid to trans people in need across the St. Louis metro region. Mm-hmm. So just direct aid. There's even been some the trans, like, sort of queer housing flat, providing low income, like, housing to trans people in need, queer and trans people in need in the St. Louis area. So he's been doing all of this incredible, incredible mutual aid work. Mm-hmm. So I really look up to him. Mm-hmm. And when his son, he has two lovely sons, and one of them came out as trans himself. And so that the first thing that he told his son when he came out to him was, find your people.
Mm-hmm.
And I've taken that to heart, because if I am alone, I might go fast, but if I'm together, I will go far, right? And the distance, this is a marathon, not a sprint, right? All of this life, all of this fighting against, you know, the settler colonial state, and, like, fighting for justice, really, this is something, this is the work of lifetimes, right? And this requires people to have, like, a maintained schedule of self-care and of community care and of reaching out to social networks to recharge, and reaching out to sort of even resources for physical needs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we are all we have is something that I like to say a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's true. Like, we can't live in individual bubbles, because everything we have comes from somewhere else. And everything that allows us to have any sort of a lifestyle, it's made by someone, or it's provided by someone, or something, if it's the earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to be in right relationship with all of those, I think that is to be a truly ethical person. But then you can't just live out in a hut in the middle of nowhere, because then you're not effecting change. Affecting change, I think, is the right word for that. Affecting change for the earth in itself. So then that's also not right relationship. If you're just doing your own thing and calling it good, you have to be fighting for collective change, and you have to be pushing for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think finding your people is so, so, so central to all of that, to sustaining yourself, and through sustaining the communities you want to be in solidarity with as an individual acting as part of a collective. So
mm-hmm.
Inshallah, I hope I said something useful.
Yeah. And before we go, I just wanted to say, mm-hmm. mashallah, your recitation was so beautiful.
Thank you.
Alhamdulillah.
Where can people find me? Is that what you asked?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can definitely send me a friend request on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram. I don't really use Twitter too much, so don't follow me there. Mm-hmm. For Instagram, my at is Bengal Brony, BENGALBRONY. And I believe that's also the URL for my Facebook. But on Facebook, I'm Amira Khan.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, of course. My pleasure.
Hi, Taylor and Nicole.
Hi.
So in retrospect, I realize I was so excited to get into me and Amira's discussion on resistance politics that I didn't actually ask Amira enough questions about herself and, like,
her queer and trans Muslimness, mm-hmm. Which is entirely on me because I'm still learning how to do this whole podcasting thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So I do encourage folks who want to hear more about Amira and her stories to check out a number of podcasts she's featured on. They'll all be linked in the episode description. They're really wonderful listens and will provide more context to what we talk about. But I also don't think that there was nothing queer and Muslim about our conversation, because this concept of being a Khalifa is super interesting, and anti-colonial struggles of solidarity, queer our understandings of place and space as something available for capitalist and imperialist exploitation, right? So there's definitely queer Muslim shit going on. I just want to emphasize how amazing and involved Amira is, and y'all should really check out the other episodes she's featured in. Inshallah, I'll have the opportunity to bring Amira back for another episode maybe one day. So we'll see. But yeah, what are your thoughts on the conversation?
I was just going to say that it always warms my heart a little bit when naturally talking about queer shit, talking about queer people and queer resistance, whatever kind of queerness that is, always means centering community, centering solidarity, mm-hmm. and like liberation movements, mm-hmm. and recognizing how everything is connected. Mm-hmm. So my favorite part about the discussion was, you know, understanding and bringing it back, our Amira's discussion about land and stewards of the land, and how that activism for the land also manifests as activism for your neighbor, showing up, being there, participating, like, mm-hmm. showing solidarity in whatever and as many ways as possible, mm-hmm. because we caring for each other is the best way for us to care also for our planet. And that means if I'm caring from the person across the world whom I can't see, I'm also aware of my consequences and how they can be globally. Mm-hmm. So when we think about that in relation to land, consumption, capitalism, pollution, and obviously the fact that our globe is dying, it takes it to a grander scale. And that was the one thing that really got me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I really liked like the centering of community and that like talking about individualistic like ideals and how that's like very, very colonial and very like related to like settler colonial ideologies, mm-hmm. And just centering community and how important it is. Absolutely, Taylor's right. And I think that Amira pointed that out a lot. Like, you can't just look at yourself. Like, when she even said, like, look at community gardening. Mm-hmm. Like, that was like a really nice like way for her to bring it back that I could understand and like conceptualize a little easier.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's something really interesting about Amira's experiences with Islam as well. She talked about Salafism and like how it's spiritual colonialism and how she grew closer to that in her youth. And I would love to know more about how she's able to navigate those sorts of ideologies with her involvement now in queer affirming, queer centered Islamic spaces. And it kind of reminds me of what Amira was saying about how when her family came to the States, her mom held on to religion as a way to find self, to affirm self, to find community in through commonalities, through sameness, through
All of the difference of immigrating to a new place, mm-hmm. finding sameness in religion and holding close to that can be a very comforting thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess I wanted to talk about further how like reverting to some like Salafism and like fundamentalist, like I find it's definitely a thing that like parents of migrant children will tend to revert back to more fundamentalist ideologies of Islam when they're in a new place. And this is not obviously for every single family, but like it's a pattern that I've noticed.
No, but I think that actually makes sense, because I've also noticed it if like people are like Orthodox Christian or Orthodox Catholic, mm. that does tend to happen. And I think it's a way of like, at least in my experience, like I think it's because culture and religion, like, they're two different things, but they're so interrelated that I feel like when you move, if you move somewhere that's so different to what you know and what you've grown up in, and like the religion isn't the same, right? So like you move from somewhere where it's like a Muslim majority country to like Canada or the US, where it's like now more secular, but it's a Christian country. Mm-hmm. And then I think like you go there, it's such a different like thing, and you want to hold on to like who you are and your culture and your home so much that sometimes it might seem easier to hold on to the stricter things because those are like the more, this is who I am and this is what we believe in. And it's harder to, like, if you are like more softer in your beliefs, I guess, I don't know if that's a right word that I want, but you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Maybe there's the idea that the lines will get blurred a little bit more and you'll become more like, I don't know, Canadian than whatever, where like that will start to overtake your identity, like within your religion. I don't know. That's what I've seen,
but you're very right, Nicole. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because if you know in your religious community, it'll probably be the easiest way for you to quote unquote acclimate to a place that's very new, because you will find commonality, you will find sameness and comfort in that sameness because it's religion and it's prescribed. So if you practice in this way, you're probably going to find many people who practice the same way around the world. That opens a door for community in a new place. Mm-hmm. And I think in a sense, the stricter you are, the easiest it is to identify people like you, because you know who is not, you know, you're supposed to be doing this and you're not supposed to be doing this. And anybody who does this or believes this or acts this way must not be like me. And so if you're looking for people who are like you, you are likely to go to the places where sameness and strict orthodoxy is expected and is celebrated, right?
That's kind of where I like what I think.
And it's so interesting because, Nicole, you said there's a fear of this Canadianness or Americanness that might take over the ways that you see yourself and the ways that you would want to be seen. Mm-hmm. But it's so interesting because what we're interested in is not affirming that Canadianness or Americanness. We're interested in the project of dismantling the notion of Canadianness and Americanness, because that is founded on and is complicit in anti-Blackness and colonialism, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's also something that I really wanted to center in this podcast, in this project, dismantling anti-Blackness and colonialism, because these are the foundations of the settler colonial capitalist state. And yeah.
I think you saying that, before you in the podcast quoted, who are the, you quoted Jody Bird and
Vimalesri et al.
Vimalesri et al. So I don't know who the second author is, but I'm obviously familiar with the concept of Black geographies. And before you quoted it, I was like, Amira was responding and I was like, this is Black geographies. Like I just said it out loud and Maha was like, and I just find it so interesting how we recognize Black and Indigenous people, the activism and the work that they do in terms of liberation work for land and for community is so tied to on the ground presence of anti-colonial land back missions. Like this sounds a little bit funny, I made that up. But what I mean to say is something that really recognizes the root and stem of it all, right? So we can fight for justice, we can fight for peace. You brought this up briefly in the podcast about dismantling versus reform. It can't just be reform if the system is built on marginalization, subjugation, and exploitation of land, of people, and of resources. So if it's not me, it's going to be you. And if it's not you, it'll be somebody else. Mm-hmm. So if you're advocating for justice and liberation, and it's oftentimes the people most marginalized who do, aka Black and Indigenous people, this is why it comes back to on the ground work. It comes back to dismantling disruptive and oppressive systems and bringing all of that shit back to the earth, the land, our water, our ability to care for ourselves mm-hmm. with the resources that we have and not exceed and exploit the earth. It, I don't know. And it's funny because I don't often think about, like, yes, I think about all of this as a Black geographic concept, to say that when I say Black geographies, for people who may not be familiar, I'm thinking about geographies that recognize space and time and culture and all of that stuff as relevant and important and geographic. So geographic in the sense as talking about how we think about space and contextualize spatial dynamics, it always comes back to on the ground, present, mm-hmm. What is really going on. And I thought that was interesting. And I love that Amira said, you know, I haven't read all the books, but I learned from the people, mm-hmm. you know, I learned from, you know, people who did all this research. And that's part of on the ground work. Like, no one's asking you to go out and get a PhD. Mm-hmm. We're just saying, get out of your back door and do some work, be ready to do work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was also the phrase that Amira said, we are all we have, which really resonated with me mm-hmm. because it's such an isolating concept, but such a liberating and humbling concept at the same time. Like, we are all we have. Everything that we do, everything that we are, is because of, for, with other people. Mm-hmm. These structures and systems that are oppressive have their roots in people, right?
They're human.
Yeah, they're human. They're upheld by humans. Mm-hmm. Humanness is not perfect, and it's important that we're able to be open to critique, be open to not naturalizing these systems. These systems are not natural, they are man-made, therefore they can be disrupted, they can be broken, mm-hmm. they can mm-hmm. be dismantled. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. People can't imagine a world without capitalism. Mm-hmm. Like, people can't imagine mm-hmm. a world where you don't have your own private property, and this is my shit, and if mm-hmm. you touch my shit, I could kill you. Like, yeah. Like, maybe it's my own fault for immersing myself in other media and other people's opinions, trying to understand where people come from. But the reality is, we are so ingrained in our systems, and they're so fundamental to how we imagine our lives, that it's so difficult to imagine a world outside of and without that. Mm-hmm. And that dreaming work is really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, you know, no one's expected to do this shit by themselves, mm-hmm. but you are expected to do work, to talk to somebody, to learn through somebody.
Mm-hmm. You can't just like hang out and assume that you're gonna be good. You have to help out as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hang out, not help out. I mean, other way around.
No.
Our new slogan.
Mahat, you said at the beginning was that you think that you thought the sentence we are all that we have was isolating. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it as being isolating, and I think it's because it actually makes me feel really comforted mm-hmm. because it's like, when you say we are all that we have, it's acknowledging your community, it's acknowledging the people that are in your life and around you. Mm-hmm. Whereas like if it was I'm all that I have, mm-hmm. it would be so incredibly isolating, so incredibly lonely. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that she, like that Amira had said, we are all that we have. Mm-hmm. And I also liked that she also related it back to the proverb, which I believe was, if on your own, you'll go fast, but together you'll go far. Mm-hmm. And I really, truly, like, that is something that I feel in my soul. Mm-hmm. Like, I just, like, I think that there's too much in the world for you to be alone. And mm-hmm. I just think that, like, with the help of other people, like, what is wrong with asking for help? Like, I don't get it. With the help of other people and with the support of other people and, like, believing in yourself, like, you'll look back on your life and you'll be able to see the things that you've been able to do for not just, like, yourself, obviously, but for your community and for the people that you love. And to try and make life better.
When I was talking about isolation, I guess I was kind of thinking about humanity versus the rest of the universe. Mm. Like, I was kind of like, humans are all we have. Like, we don't know what else is out there.
Right.
Ooh. We are, like, right? I got too existential too fast. But,
but that's what came to your mind, so.
Yeah.
Okay, that I can see.
No, but it's also it makes realize that we have to hold on to what we have because we are all that we have.
I guess the one thing I really want to say, sorry, and this is maybe, I said it right in the beginning, so it might just be like a circular thing, is the point for me of doing radical work that is meaningful is the fact that you're doing it and you're seeking community. And Amira said, when she was interviewing or talking to somebody on another podcast, I think, mm-hmm. That they're trans and their child also is trans. And the advice that they gave their child was, find your people, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that's the thing, like, that's the thing about queerness, the fact that it's outside of the norm, it goes against what we see and view as normative, although the insidious thing about normativity is that it's always seeking to envelope queerness. Mm-hmm. We know this. So the idea of that community and finding your community can be sort of the radical work of queer people, mm-hmm. is cool shit. And I want us to just, I don't know, I wanted to end on that because that was awesome that Amir said it, and I believe in that.
Oh yeah, you gotta find your people to be able to be who you are and, like, just to feel, like, loved.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Queer Muslim Resistance. As always, you can find relevant links in the episode description. Make sure to check us out on Instagram for links to our Queer Muslim resource guide, to Tarif, a queer Muslim reading group, and for awesome queer Muslim content in general. You can email us at queermuslimresistance@gmail.com for any inquiries, additional resources you'd like to see added to the resource guide, or just say hi.